podcast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner, and I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at CrowdSpring Utah. Today's topic is a look at the new year, breaking down the 2026 DevEx wrapper, hosted by Dale Krause, founder and CEO here at CrowdSpring Utah. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the question section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as this is a CLE requirement in order for you to receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Dale, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Katie. Well, it's great to be back. 2026 is just starting out, and the first webinar for me for the year is the 2026 desk reference. This is something, you know, going back 30-some years when I first started Krause Financial Services, you know, it was one of the things I needed as a tool to help me get through certain cases. So if an elder law attorney called me from Arizona and wanted to work with us, you know, and I needed to know what the numbers were for the particular state in order to help them design and develop the Medicaid crisis plan. And so the desk reference was one of the first things that I developed internally to make my job easier. And as a result of it, many of the attorneys I worked with would say, hey, do you have a copy of that for me? And the next thing you know, the desk reference became one of the tools in their toolbox in order to help them have the numbers handy when meeting with clients. And so this is something I developed for my own use, and in the process of keeping it up over the years for the last 30 some years, it's still a handy tool that I think you should have as part of your plan. So a little bit about Krause Financial Services. I began as an attorney practicing law and doing estate planning, working primarily in the industry of revocable living trusts. I was a young attorney in 85, and I joined a firm where the senior partner was putting just about all of the clients in a revocable living trust for purposes of convenience, privacy, cost. And as a result of working with those clients, being the young associate, my job was to facilitate the opportunities for them once the trust was in play and everything was moving on. And so as clients started to come back, I was faced with the question, how does the trust help them with Medicaid planning? And that's where I actually ran into the situation of, well, what is Medicaid? And I asked myself the question, I didn't really know. But in Michigan, the trust created a problem because anytime a house is put into a living trust, it would make an accountable resource, subjecting it to a spend down, which wouldn't be, you know, something that they had to face had the trust been in their own names. And so as that young attorney, I took it upon myself to try to figure out, well, how does the living trust integrate with Medicaid and all of that? And as a result of developing one of the first products in the Medicaid compliant annuity arena, I then took it national through NALA, and other attorneys took notice as to what I was doing. And lo and behold, Krause Financial Services became a financial services industry. What really happened is I was spending so much time on the phone with other attorneys on their cases that there wasn't time to handle my own caseload. And so seeing the opportunity, I then started Krause Financial Services. Well, today, with more than 30 years of experience, we have 40 employees on staff that are there to help you. And we're currently doing about 400 cases a month, you know, on new cases. So our job really is to empower you so that you can do very well. Because what I've always said in this industry is your success is our success. And the more we can help you and the more you help your clients, you know, just it goes around. So I want to thank you for letting me be here today and for taking advantage of this opportunity, which I think you'll find quite interesting, especially if you're new to elder law and crisis Medicaid plan. So today I got three goals. First, I'm going to talk about the terms that are found on the Medicaid desk reference. But then what I'm going to do is I identify how they impact your client's plan and how you can use them. So one of the things I found that with the desk reference in hand, if a client's come to you and they want to know, well, how can Medicaid help them? You know, by looking at the desk reference and knowing what they're privately paying, and then let's say it's a husband and wife case, husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home, I know that the worst case scenario, and probably the case, would be that all of the husband's income would go to the nursing home. And that would be the maximum out-of-pocket or copay. And so it was easily, from looking at the desk staff and knowing what they have, basically, because they give you a general idea, and then knowing their individual incomes, it didn't take me long to say, well, look, if you do Medicaid crisis planning, we put the plan in play and the eligibility is on hand, we're going to reduce your monthly out-of-pocket costs from, say, $9,000, which is what the nursing home was charging, to whatever the husband's income was, less his personal needs allowance. And so most clients, they, you know, they don't want to really know all the legalese. They want to just know what's the impact and how soon can they get that financial savings to take place. And so that's really the importance of having those key figures in front of you with meeting with clients. And then the last thing I'm going to do is really explore how the calculations come into the figures. We'll talk about the SESRA, the NMNA, and all of those other terms as we go through this desk reference. Now, the desk reference really is a one-sheet summary of each individual state financial numbers related to their Medicaid program. And you'll see on the screen, we've got Wisconsin and we've got Florida. They're a little different because each of the states have some things that are unique to them. But the desk reference really is a tool that you can get all of the numbers and have them all right in front of you, which will help you to assess the situation. So again, each state has their own desk reference. And so if you're in a particular state and you need your desk reference, the thing to do is contact us or go into the attorney access portion of our website and request a copy. Now, what the desk reference really does is it helps you to determine how many assets can your client keep, how much income or income limitations do you have at hand, and then if the spouse is eligible for an income shift. And what we're really talking about is the monthly maintenance leads allowance. And by having all of these reference numbers handy and knowing a little bit about what your clients have, whether it be assets or income, you can start to make some adjustments so that they can see that there's a real mechanism to how they qualify for Medicaid. So when one of these desk reference is updated, well, typically there's three time periods. The first is January. That's when the community spouse resource allowance is established, that we know what the number is. Those numbers just came out, and so we have all of those numbers now in our 2026 desk reference. And then the maximum MIMA, that's the maximum monthly maintenance needs allowance, that number is typically adjusted in January. And then with the divestment penalty divisor, that's the monthly amount or the amount that states use to penalize potential gifts that are made within the five-year lookback. Now, another time that these numbers change is July. That's when the minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance number is established. And then some states where the divestment penalty divisor was not established in January, they would do it in July. And then the last date that's important regarding the doctor athletes is October. That's when we set the shelter standard. What is the amount that the community spouse is responsible for in a state where you have a high-low MIMNA and you got to calculate it? The shelter standard is what the community spouse's contribution towards the monthly shelter expenses is. And you need that number in order to calculate the MIMNA if you're in a state where you got a minimum, maximum MIMNA. Some states have just a flat number, but if you're in a state with a high-low, you have to have that. And then the standard utility allowance. States really don't want to look at utility bills in the cases because, you know, every state has multiple different utilities and charges and things like that. And so what the states do is they just assess the utility allowance, a monthly allowance that you use in your calculations when working on the MIMNA. Oh, where can you find your desk reference? Well, I think the easiest thing to do is go to our Cross Financial Services website, and you'll see the login information here on this page. And just type in your state, and you'll find access to your desk reference. And then, you know, if you don't have access to the internet and you really want one, you can give us a call or contact us by email, and we certainly can get you one that way. So when we're defining the Medicaid figures, you know, you know, first you want to say, what does it mean? What does the figure mean? You know, and where is the figure used? And then why is the figure important? These are all of the things that we're going to try to cover as we explore each and every one of the points of reference. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is asset regulation. You'll see it here on this Colorado desk reference. It's really the first thing on the summary sheet, asset regulation. And we've got highlighted with the orange box is divestment penalty device. Well, the divestment penalty divisor, if someone gives away something of value within the 5 years preceding a Medicaid application, the state does not allow them to go immediately on Medicaid benefits because the state is going to want to penalize them based on the amount that was given away and by using the divisor to calculate that.
Sure.
And so the divisor is important to know if a client comes to you and they say, look, we gave certain things away. There's no way we can cure the gift. In other words, they can't get it back. And they're going to be subject to a penalty related to it. In that instance, we know in Colorado that divisor amount is $10,814 per month. And so it's really what we would say would be the average cost of care in a Medicaid bed in Colorado. So, or, you know, private pay bed, Medicaid bed. Some states, there's not much difference. In other states, there could be a significant difference. But it's really the private pay cost per month for a bed in a nursing home. So when we break down the divestment penalty divisor, what we're really doing is we're on the Medicaid application, there's a question which says, in the last 5 years, have you given away something of value for which you didn't get anything in return? You know, they want to know when was the date of the gift, what was the amount, and then all of those gifts are pooled together to come up with a total that then the penalty divisor is used, is divided into that amount, which then establishes how many months you're going to be ineligible for Medicaid benefits. Now, what constitutes a gift? Well, as lawyers, we know that, you know, I've seen deeds in the past where it's given, they give the deed to the house to the children for $1, and that is good and valuable consideration. But, you know, a dollar is exchanged being the consideration for the transfer. But anything you give away, whether, you know, you give it to an irrevocable trust, they give it to a transfer of home ownership of a car or a vehicle, or give away cash to family members, or, you know, making a little tithing to the church. Certain things, depending on the state you're in, can cause a penalty based on the value of those gifts. So, again, everything in the 5 years before the Medicaid application is defined and then totaled, and then the divisor is divided into it, and then from there we come up with a term for which they would be ineligible for Medicaid benefits, assuming they are eligible. So the penalty period does not start to run until someone is otherwise eligible. In other words, they are now down to the level of assets that they're allowed to have, and they have made gifts, and they are subject to a penalty. And then because they have economic eligibility, penalty period starts where they're refused Medicaid benefits until the penalty ends. So how do we calculate it? Well, again, we take the total amount of the gifts. So if they gave certain things away 5 years ago, we would put that down, the date, the amount, and then 4 years ago, 3, 2, 1, and we total everything over that five-year time period immediately preceding the Medicaid application. And then we do the division with a calculator. And on the calculator, the whole number is the number of months they're ineligible. And then the fractional portion would be the number of days. And so you've got to actually calculate it all out, lay it on a calendar, and then determine what is the ineligibility period. But as a practitioner planner, I would always advise clients who are doing traditional estate planning to understand and know that if they're thinking about the nursing home and they don't have long-term care insurance or nursing home insurance, and they're really thinking about going on Medicaid, they got to be very careful not to make gifts within that five-year period, because if they don't have eligibility, they're going to have to privately pay through that time period before they can get eligible. And so if they really get down to the minimum levels that they're required to have to get on Medicaid, the question sometimes becomes, how are we going to pay for that time period for which we're ineligible. But again, the rule of thumb and the things that I would do to advise clients, never give away anything of value in the 5 years before you suspect you may need nursing home care. Now, most clients are going to say, well, I don't know when that is, but, you know, my health is relatively good, but I'm now reaching my late 70s and maybe possibly 80s. The question becomes, anyone could go to a nursing home because things do happen, strokes and things of that nature. So they got to be really careful. I typically advise them not to make those gifts unless they're certain they can make it past that five-year window. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is the individual resource allowance. That's the next thing on the sheet here, and you'll see the Idaho one. The individual resource allowance is $2,000. This is the amount of countable assets that the person in the nursing home can have and still be eligible for Medicaid benefits. So it could be an individual who's all alone, or it could be the person in the nursing home in a husband and wife situation. So if the husband goes in the wife's at home, he can only have $2,000 of countable resources in the state of Idaho and be eligible for Medicaid benefits. If he has $3,000 in his name, he is not eligible. And so most of the states use $2,000, but states like New York and others will have variance from the $2,000 threshold. So even though it is typically the same in most states, you still have to go to your desk reference in your state to determine what it is. And until the excess assets in that person's name is spent down, they're not economically eligible for Medicaid benefits. So let's talk about exempt versus countable assets. Because again, I said that person in nursing home can have $2,000 of countable assets. Things that are not counted. Medicaid doesn't care about the primary residence. And again, there's some caveats related to it in terms of value. But generally speaking, primary residence, nobody cares about it. One vehicle, nobody cares. Personal and household effects, not worried about it. Small whole life insurance policies, generally a $1,500 face or less, the state doesn't care about it. And then funeral expense trusts up to $15,000. So they can have a funeral expense trust, which is a policy of insurance that they get from an insurance company that's then earmarked for the funeral expenses, or they go directly to a funeral home and work with them on a more direct way. But the exempt assets, we're not worried about those. So when we're talking about what an individual can retain and be eligible for Medicaid, it's not items in green. What we're talking about is the items in orange here, checking accounts, savings, CDs, stocks, bonds, extra real estate, extra vehicles, and then IRAs in some states are also countable. And we do have the 2026 Krauss report. We put that together. That's a short little book on the Medicaid rules and regulations. And it's more comprehensive than the one-page desk reference. But in that 2026 desk, in that Krauss report, we have the states, whether your IRA is countable in your particular state. So I would recommend when you go into attorney access, look at getting that 2026 Krauss report. So once we know what assets are exempt, what are countable, and really when we're using the desk reference, we're trying to figure out the countable assets. How many of the countable assets can the individual in the nursing home have? You know, it's typically 2,000. And how many countable assets can the community spouse, if the case involves, say, a husband and wife, and say the husband in the nursing home, the wife's at home, how many of the countable assets can the wife maintain and still find eligibility for the husband? And then, as we all know, if they have too many countable assets, they have to spend down in order to find economic eligibility. So now let's talk about resource allowance for a couple. Now, again, we're not talking about a husband and wife, husband in nursing home, the wife's at home. We're talking about we're a couple. Both of them are in the nursing home. Now, in my years of practice, I've only seen that a few times where both are in the nursing home. You just don't see it that often. But if both are in the nursing home and they're in Arkansas, the resource allowance for a couple is $3,000. Because you don't have someone in the community, in other words, they're both in a nursing home, most likely going on Medicaid benefits, the maximum amount of total assets they can have is $3,000. So again, if you're faced with that case, you know that it's not, they're not getting a community spouse resource allowance because you don't have a community spouse out in the community because they're both in a nursing home in a bed, their limitation is going to be $3,000. So again, generally speaking, I know that number is pretty consistent from state to state, but you still want to look at your individual desperate needs to make sure. And again, so if the couple is both in the nursing home, we know that they can only have $3,000 in countable resources to find eligibility for Medicaid benefits. So when we break down the resource allowance for a couple, you know, if a single person goes in, they get to keep $2,000. So you'd think that they would get to keep four if it's a couple, but for some reason, someone decided $3,000 was the more correct amount. And again, it does vary from state to state, but I think it's pretty common that $2,000 and $3,000 thresholds. And so, you know, that's not very much. If the couple is both nursing home and they can only keep $3,000, really doesn't give them a lot of opportunity. And we know that everything else that they would have to be spent down in order to find eligibility. So now let's move on to income regulation. First thing I'm going to talk about is the personal needs allowance. You'll see on the West Virginia desk reference, it's $50. What this amount does is it allows the person in the nursing home, because we typically know that when someone's in a nursing home, they generally give all of their monthly income to the facility, and the only thing they get to keep is they get to keep a personal needs allowance. It's a very small amount. In West Virginia, $50. It allows them to do things like get their hair cut, you know, buy toothpaste and things of that nature. And so even though it's quite small and it does change from state to state, it could be a lot more if you're in New York, it is the amount that we are allowed to them to retain. So once they find economic Medicaid eligibility and their copay is the challenge, their copay is all of their monthly income, less anything that would go to the community spouse's shifting of income, again, assuming there is a community spouse. If there isn't a community spouse, and so you've got the situation where this person's all alone, or say both parties are in the nursing home, they are going to maintain only the $50 each month in order to maintain their personal items, things that the nursing home generally doesn't provide. So when we break down the personal needs allowance, we know that all of their income, we know that when people go on Medicaid, and say in a husband and wife case, I know, generally speaking, but if the wife has more income than the men know, we know that all the husband's income is going to go to the nursing home. And so we can tell that family rather quickly, based on the income that the two of you have, the wife is going to maintain all of her income, the husband's going to give up all of his income, less than personal needs allowance. And so, again, it's to get those items that they can't generally get. Now, one thing you don't want to have cases, and I've seen it not too often, but you see it from time to time, you know, let's say that the person's all alone and we left them with $2,000 and now they're getting $50 a month. But for whatever reason, the children decide, no, we're not going to take dad's money out of his account. We're just going to let that $50 accumulate. If it suddenly did accumulate, because in the month of receipt, $50 is deemed income. And then as it sits in that account the first and the next month, it's now an asset. And so the family could face the problem of now that they've got too many countable resources, because now say that $2,050, now it's $2,100 because the children did want to go into dad's bank account in order to pay for things that he needed personally. So you don't want to face that. You typically want the family to know that if $50 goes in, it should pretty much come out. And I see from the nursing home bills and all of the charges that I see out there, that if someone gets their hair done in a facility or other personal items, that $50 is going to go away pretty quickly. It's generally not going to be enough. So now let's talk about the income cap. Now we're looking at the Arizona desk reference, and you'll see the income cap. It's $2,982. So what this means is that states that have an income cap basically allege, and most families get rather confused when we explain this to them, but in Arizona, if an individual in the nursing home, say they're all alone, and they're not qualifying for Medicaid, but they have $3,500 of monthly income from Social Security pension. And we know that they got to give up all their monthly income less the personal needs allowance, which is $149.10. We know that your copay is going to be more than $29.82. Well, the Medicaid rules basically say that if you're in an income cap state and the person in the facility's copay is more than that amount, they are not eligible for Medicaid benefits because their income is too high. Now, families will say, wait a second, the nursing home's charging $10,000. I understand that, you know, my father has X number of dollars of income and it's slightly above the income cap, but with only that amount of money, how are we going to pay a $10,000 nursing home bill? It's impossible, but yet if we don't qualify for Medicaid, we're going to be forced to. Well, what we have to do in those states is we have to do what's called there's a special income only trust, which is known as a Miller Trust or a qualified income trust. In those states, if you're subject to that income cap, the monthly income, rather than have it go from dad's account directly to a facility, would go each month into that qualified income trust or Miller Trust. And then the trustee, which generally would be probably one of the kids, would then pay it to the facility. As long as dad's check is less than $29.82, and it would be if all of his income goes to the QIT, he would be eligible for Medicaid. So families say, well, wait a second. So if we run the same income, instead of directly having it go, that dad uses, we set up this bank account, and we flow the money through that, and the trustee makes the check out the facility. Now we're eligible? The answer is yes. And so it's very important, well, if you're working with clients and you're in income cap state, that you do establish this trust, because any time that you try to qualify a client and they have the requirement of a Miller Trust or a qualified income trust, and their income was over the threshold, technically they were not eligible. And so this is something I'm sure that you have in place. And so a lot of times if your client is close or you have clients saying close, it better be utilized qualified income trust or Miller Trust as a conduit vehicle to avoid a potential problem. So say some month they get this extra income, they could be over in one month, maybe not over the other months. And so you want to avoid that issue. So if the clients are close or there's a potential for going over that income gap, I would just say put a Miller Trust or a QIT in place and utilize it. Because, again, it's just a little extra step, but it certainly gives you the safety to know that they're not going to be disqualified. So when we think of a QIT, a truly irrevocable income-only trust, I think of it as a conduit. So things that flow in generally flow in each month, and each month they should flow out. And that's another important point, because sometimes clients will say, well, we're not going to be able to get to the QIT and make the payment this month because we're on vacation. But it has to be automatic, because income coming in really needs to go out in the same month to be qualified as the income. And so it really is a conduit. Comes in, it goes out. Comes in, goes out. And so when we look at that trust agreement and the account that's established for it, as the income flows in, by the end of the month, pretty much should all flow out. There should be no retainage in the account. And so the things that can be paid out of the QIT, of course, the personal needs allowance, because the person nursing home needs to get that amount. So it could go from the QIT directly to the facility that has an account on hand to use for purchases for that person. Now, if the person in the nursing home has got a healthy spouse at home and some of their income is then directed to the spouse at home because the spouse at home's income is below their MIMNA, then the QIT could pay that difference that you're allowed to pay to the community spouse. And then other certain medical expenses, anything medically that they incur can be paid out of it. Again, typically the money is not there to cover it. And then their Medicaid copay, which is the amount of income that they're required to pay the facility each month. So again, it's a simple format. I think clients get confused because it seems like an unnecessary step, but it's a very critical step if you're in an income cap state. So now let's talk about the QIT gross income gap. Now, again, I'm looking, this isn't something I see in very many states, but if you look at Oklahoma, Oklahoma has an income cap of $2,982 and a QIT gross income cap of $7,535. The assumption there is that the facility is not charging more than $7,535 private pay. And because of that, you know, if your income were to go at that amount or above, you're not eligible for Medicaid under any circumstances. So again, I think it's good if the private pay rates are equal to this amount or less, but it certainly would not be fair if nursing homes are charging substantially more than that, because occasionally from time to time, I'll see a client that has a nursing home insurance policy and they're collecting benefits and along with their other income, you know, it is substantial, but it's not near enough to pay the whole bill. And so I could see a problem in, say, a state of Oklahoma where they had a really good nursing home insurance policy that was on payout, and then their monthly income was quite strong, they could face a problem. But again, I think in Oklahoma, it must be, it has to be that the nursing homes are charging $75.35 or something less than that in order for that cap to really do what it needs to do. So when we break down the QIT gross income stat, some states apply it as an additional cap above the income cap. So you have the lower amount and the top threshold amount. And so it's really what you refer to as a hard cap. If they have a penny over that amount, they're just not eligible for Medicaid, and there's no way to get them eligible because there would be no way to divert. And then some states have a set figure, while others will equate it to the facility's Medicaid reimbursement rate. So again, it's a little more technical, but you know, the general consensus would be that gross income cap maximum is close to whatever the facility would get for taking care of that resident or patient. Now let's talk about spousal impoverishment standards. First thing I want to talk about is the community spouse resource allowance. So here we've got the Rhode Island desk reference. We see the minimum community spouse resource allowance is $32,532, and the maximum is $162,660. So what this does is it tells us that in Rhode Island, we've got to determine what the accountable resources are on a specific day so that we can determine what does the community spouse get for their resource allowance. So you have one of two states. You have a state with a high-low like Rhode Island, where you've got to actually calculate it. So we know in calculating it for a client, we're going to have a number somewhere between $32,000 and $162,000. But if you're in a state with just a threshold amount, it could be $162,660. If you're in a state like that, we don't have to do a calculation, try to figure out what it is. We know that the community spouse would get that maximum in retaining accountable resources. So when we break down the community spouse resource allowance, what we're doing is we're looking at their asset. Oh, so if, for example, we have a husband and wife, husband's in nursing home, wife's at home, we know that he gets his $2,000 asset limitation. And then what we got to do is we got to figure out, you know, how much of the accountable resources does the community spouse get? So again, if you have a state and your desk reference has one number, say $162,660, I know that the maximum amount that can be retained accountable assets in that state, where you have a husband, say, in the nursing home, the wife's healthy and at home, would be $164,660. Meaning that if they have $200,000 in accountable resources, they've got to spend down to that threshold amount. Now, the minimum maximum states, you know, we've got to perform a calculation. And so what we've got to do is we've got to go back to what's called the snapshot date, the date after which the institutionalized person, say the husband, had 30 consecutive days of care. So if he goes directly from the house into the nursing home and he's there 30 days now, and then the clients come to you and say, what do we have to do? You go back because you've got a 30-day window that person has been continuously in the facility. You go back to the first date and you look at that date, and then you look at their accountable resources on that snapshot date and you total them up. What did they have on that date? It's total. If the total was $200,000, we know the community spouse gets one hand, but no more or no less than those thresholds. So if it was $200,000, we know the community spouse gets $100,000 as her protected resource amount. So in that case, the community spouse would get $100,000, the husband in nursing home gets $2,000, they've got $102,000 that's protecting. Then you look at the remaining amount of assets, because again, the assets could have gone down since the snapshot date because they privately paid the facility. But whatever's left in the countable resource box has to be spent down to get to $102,000. Now, if they have $400,000 in countable resources, I know that half the countable resources is $200,000. But I know the limit's $162,660. So if that's the actual case and the snapshot date reflects $400,000 in assets, the community spouse doesn't get $200,000. She only gets the maximum $162,660. In another example, if they have $50,000 in countable resources on the snapshot date, I know that the community spouse is going to get the $32,000 by 32, which is the minimum of the 50. $2,000 is then allocated to the institutionalized spouse, and the rest has to be spent down for Medicaid eligible. So again, it sounds confusing, but after you do it a few times, the thing you got to remind yourself of is, when was the snapshot date? What were the countable resources on that date? Because they could have significantly less or significantly more. Sometimes, you know, a family will establish the snapshot date, the house sells, and the house, then is all of the proceeds from the house sale go into the account, and yet they haven't qualified for Medicaid, when now you're going to have substantially more resources than it can be spent down, even though the snapshot date does not reflect the sale of the house. But again, that would be problematic because you'd have to spend down more of those assets in order to find eligibility. So where does this apply? Well, the minimum and maximum states are in green. So in Wisconsin, where I'm located, you know, we've got a minimum and maximum. I've got to look at the snapshot date. I've got to do my analysis. I've got to figure out what's left and then spend down in order to find eligibility. In the gray states, such as Florida, it's just a threshold amount. You don't have to figure out the snapshot date. You don't have to know the minimum and maximum. You're given a set amount, and the community spouse gets to keep that. The husband in there keeps his $2,000. Everything else has to be spent down. Now we're going to turn to income. So now we're going to talk about the monthly maintenance needs allowance. And the desk reference you're looking at is Montana. The minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance is $2,643.75. The maximum is $4,066.50. So I know in Montana that the husband and wife, see, the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home, he wants to know how much of the monthly income does she get to keep. Well, I know that if her monthly income is over $4,066, that she gets to keep it all. Whatever comes in her name, she keeps. So if it's $5,000, $10,000, she keeps it all. I just know that she gets none of the husband's income, because the monthly maintenance needs allowance number is really to protect the community spouse who has a low monthly income. Somewhere, you know, in the range of, a lot of times, you know, the community spouse might have $1,500. Well, I know that the minimum is $2,643. And so the community spouse in that case would be impoverished because she'd have insufficient monthly income to meet her needs. We know that some of his income is going to shift or go to get to the month. But what's more important in Montana is you got to actually calculate it based on the shelter extent. So when we do it, we have to look at the fact that you're going to get more than the minimum, but you could get up to the maximum. And the way we have to do it is we've got to calculate what are the monthly shelter expenses. And then we know the community spouse is responsible for a portion of those. It's the excess amount that gets added to the minimum and then establishes the hard minimum. So again, sounds like a lot of words. It sounds like it's complicated, but it's really not. Once you get into these cases, you know what to look for, you'll find that it's very easy. And so if you're in a standard state, unlike the one we just talked about, that's where it's $4,066.50. I know that if you're one of those states, the community spouse gets $4,066.50. So if she only has $2,000 in her name, she gets $2,066.50 from her husband's income before we determine what he's going to end up paying at the sale. Again, it's important to know what your state uses. Is it a minimum maximum or is it a flat or a threshold state? So when we look at the minimum maximum, we got to look at all of the shelter expenses that the community spouse pays for. And then we also have to look at the shelter standard, which is the amount of money that she's responsible to pay towards the total shelter expenses. And then we've got our standard utility allowance. What happens is states don't want to look at all of the independent utility bills. They don't want to look at the water bill, the heating bill, because of these bills adjust. And so what the state says is if you live in your own home and you pay utilities, we're going to give you a flat rate amount, which you then add to the list of shelter expenses. So someone living in their own family home might have just real estate taxes, homeowners insurance, and utilities. So we know the utilities is going to be a flat rate amount. We know that the taxes, we divide the amount by 12, and the homeowners insurance, again, we can divide by 12 to come up with their monthly shelter expenses. But if someone has a mortgage, that would be part of those shelter expenses. If someone's subject to a condo and they have an HOA fee, that's part of it. So whatever they pay each month towards shelter expenses, we total it up, we subtract what the community spouse is responsible for, we take the excess amount, and then add that to the base minimum to come up with an actual. So if someone's living very affluently and in a very expensive place, the maximum they can get for monthly income is $4,066. So that's the maximum amount of income that they can get if their monthly income is insufficient to meet their minimum, because that's all the caseworker can allot. The minimum is pretty low. The maximum, you know, again, I don't see too many cases near that amount. So when we look at the shelter standard, again, the shelter standard is what is the community spouse responsibility? Well, if you look at this Minnesota desk reference, you'll see that the community spouse is responsible for this first $794. So let's say the total shelter expenses are $2,000. We subtract the $794 from it, which leaves us a shortfall. It's the shortfall that gets added to the base NIMNA, $2,645, which gives us our actual NIMNA. And so the resulting number typically is in between the $2,645 and the $4,066. But again, this is all important because when you're developing a plan for the clients, you know, you don't need to get into this with the clients on the first round. In the first round, typically the clients want to know how can Medicaid help them to get away from what they're currently privately paying. So if they're paying $10,000 a month, and we know it's a husband-wife situation, the wife's at home, the husband's in nursing home, I look at his income and they say it's $1,500. I can say, I can tell you this, you're not going to pay anything more than $1,500 per month by going on Medicaid, knowing those basic facts. Now, again, we'll get into these details with them and come up with our number once you spend more time with them. But I think what's important for families to know, we're currently paying X, how can we get on Medicaid, and what's the resulting copay amount? Because that's what encourages them to take the next step. So when we break down the shelter standard, it's basically, you know, the amount that the community spouse is responsible for. We typically see that number of $793.13. So again, the total monthly expenses subtract $793.13 from it. The difference is the amount of excess. The excess adds to the base minimum, which then establishes the community spouse's monthly income need. And so, again, it's very important to determine that amount, because it all becomes important in your financial plan to make sure they have enough funds to survive. The standard utility allowance, again, that's nothing more than a set figure. So if you look at this one, Pennsylvania, it's $857 for the utility allowance. And you can see the shelter standard is $794. So when someone lives in their own home in Pennsylvania, they're going to get off the base amount of the minimum monthly maintenance fees law, because utilities alone gets them up, and I think that's about $63 difference. So they're never going to have the minimum of the needs allowance. It's always going to be that amount or more. But again, it'll be somewhere less than the maximum. So when we're breaking down the standard utility allowance, it's really nothing more. Instead of looking at all the utility bills and trying to figure it out, we just use a hard number, and that's part of the total monthly shelter expenses. So where does the minimum and maximum apply? If you're in one of the orange states, you've got to figure out what the MIMNA is by doing the actual shelter expenses and figure it out so the community spouse knows what she's going to get as a monthly income source. Because, again, if she has all of these bills, she's going to want to know that she can afford to pay them. If you're in one of the gray states, then it's just a flat amount. We know that the community spouse gets X number of dollars above the income each month. And so you don't have to go and figure out the shelter expenses. You just take the hard number and apply it to the case. So now let's talk about exempt asset limitation. The first one I want to talk about is the funeral expense trust limit. Now, funeral expense trust is different than if a client goes to a funeral home and sets up a funeral plan, because most funeral homes will do that, where they directly go in, pick out the goods and services, and lock it all up in a contract. But it seems like today with portability, and a lot of clients don't know where their final resting spot is, because I know from practicing in the 80s, a lot of clients had family plots at the cemetery, and they would have specific spots for everyone, but I don't hear or see of those specific plots anymore. So I think with portability and the fact that clients aren't always sure if they're going to be cremated or where their final resting spot is, a lot of clients lean towards the funeral expense trust, which is nothing more than an insurance product that an insurance company offers, which is earmarked for the funeral expenses. So once they establish it, it's irrevocable. It's designed to pay funeral expenses. And if you look in Kentucky, you know, they can have a $15,000 funeral expense trust. So again, in Kentucky, it requires a goods and services contract, which means you got to establish what the $15,000 is for. Is it for the casket, the vault, the funeral home services, whatever? But you have to have those itemized expenses if you're in Kentucky. So when you break down the funeral expense trust limit, you know, I tell most clients, you really got to have a funeral plan in place, because it's not something that your children typically want to face at the time of death, because it's tough to make decisions. That time of life is quite uneasy, and, you know, it's hard for children who maybe don't make some of those financial decisions to make decisions. Should we do this? Should we do that? So I advise most clients to try to establish a funeral plan so that one less decision should the kids have to make. And so the funeral trust is a great way to do that. And again, depending on your state, will require if they need the goods and services letter to accompany it. Now, the goods and services thing, again, I explained it, pretty much just identifies how the $15,000 or whatever amount they decided to spend is going to be utilized for the funeral. Now, a life insurance limit. I don't see as much of this as I used to see, but a lot of times in the old days, it seemed like a lot of the MetLife agents were selling $1,500 life insurance policies, which were designed to allow for extra expenses related to a funeral. So if they had a funeral plan with the funeral home, and, you know, sometimes there's things that couldn't be covered under the funeral home, like maybe the opening of the grave, or maybe something that they want to give the priest or minister, or maybe certain flowers, they couldn't be contractually put in the contract. And so I saw a lot of these $1,500 life insurance policies many years ago, too, like everybody seemed to have one. And the whole life policy has cash. And so if the face is $1,500 or less, nobody counted it. But if the face value was over $1,500, then the cash value became a countable resource. So again, these are still handy. If someone's got a small spend down and your state, like Texas, allows a $1,500 life insurance exemption, you know, they could set up one of these policies and leave it on the sidelines. It's not going to cause an ineligibility issue unless they have more life insurance. So I know term insurance generally is not covetable because there's no cash value, but if they have anything other in the life insurance things, once the face goes over, then it becomes a countable resource based on the total face of the insurance policy. So the life insurance limit's really been $1,500. I'm not sure what it feels tied to. I just know in the old days it was related to some of the loose expenses related to a funeral, but other than that, all I can share with you on that. And then the home equity limit, you know, I'm looking at the Illinois desk reference, and the home equity limit is $752,000. Now, again, this limit only applies to the individual going to the nursing home. So if there's a healthy spouse at home, you know, there's no limit on the house. It's just if someone's all alone and they're going to a nursing home, the expectation is that they don't need a house. But if they had a house valued at more than $752,000, it would cause them an asset eligibility problem. And so if they're below that threshold and their equity is below, not a problem. So if the house is $300,000, $400,000, it doesn't cause a problem. So I know if you're in one of the more affluent states, Connecticut, real estate can get quite pricey very quickly. But if you're in the Midwest, you know, $752,000, you know, that's still a pretty good house. And I think a lot of seniors would have things much less than that. So I don't think most seniors would have an eligibility issue regarding that. The home equity limit really is, it's somewhere between $752,000 and $1.130. So it's up to over $1 million in other states. But again, you want to check with your desk reference in your state, make sure you have the hard number for your state, but not usually a problem. I don't usually see it to be a problem. Of course, you know, clients can take money out of their house to reduce that home equity, whether they have a reverse mortgage or something like that. So again, I think there's ways around it. If you know that it's going to be a problem down the road and they really want to maintain the house to the end, then you're going to have to address that issue as the plan. So again, the exception is the home equity limit. If you have a home, if you have a house and there's a community spouse or a minor or disabled child occupying it, then, you know, there's no limit. It's going to be well over those threshold numbers with no problem. So it looks like we're at the end, and I have some time for some questions.
Our first question, I am working on a case involving a couple, and the community spouse lives in a condo and pays a monthly HOA fee of $800. Is the amount included in the monthly shelter expenses?
Yes, an HOA fee, which is a homeowners association. You know, it's a fee that's charged for, typically you'll see them with condos and developments where the developer secure the grass, lawn care, all of the snow plowing and all of that. So an HOA fee is part of a monthly expense and would be part of the shelter expenses for the month. So you would be able to include.
Our next question. In your presentation, you utilized the Pennsylvania desk reference when discussing the utility allowance. I noticed that the standard utility allowance was $857, while the shelter standard was $794. Based on the facts, every community spouse who pays for utilities is entitled to an MMNA of $2,644 plus $63, the base minimum plus the utility add-on. Is my assessment correct?
Yeah, exactly. I think I briefly touched on that, but no, that's exactly correct. The utility allowance in Pennsylvania is more than the shelter standard, meaning that if the community spouse gets the shelter standard because they own their own home, they're automatically going to push their MMNOP, and actually the person calculated it. So that $63 is correct. So anytime someone pays utilities in Minnesota, they're going to be off the base MMNOP. They have a number higher than the minimum. So that is correct.
The next question. I'm involved in a case where the husband is an institutionalized spouse, and he has been on Medicaid. His wife, the community spouse, is not receiving the maximum in that, but could have if her monthly shelter expenses were higher. If she were to obtain a home equity loan with a monthly payment equal to the shortfall, would she be entitled to the maximum in that?
Yes. Actually, I wrote an article on that many years ago, and I addressed that issue where if you've got clients who have longevity, and they're still paying, but yet the community spouse isn't getting the maximum, by taking out a small loan, it could be a home equity loan, and having a monthly payment so that the loan expires every year, every 13 months, it would be a simple way for the community spouse to get a lump sum of cash that they would borrow And then because they're getting the increase in dividend, they would pay back the loan with the extra proceeds that they weren't getting otherwise. And so it's somewhat of an opportunity. So if someone's interested in that, actually doing that, I do have an article and I think we can make it available to them.
Our last question, I am preparing for my first Medicaid crisis planning case. Does CAHPS provide analysis to help ensure I do not make mistakes in the calculations and spend down?
Yeah, no, that's one of the things I take great pride in is the fact that I think our success over the years has come about because of the success that the elder attorneys that work with clients have. And I think whatever we can do to bulletproof the plan, or at least give them the comfort to know that they're on the right path, you know, we're willing to do that. So if someone contacts us with their first case and says, look, I need some help, I want to make sure I assessed everything correctly and make calculations make sense, we certainly would go through that together, a planning letter at no cost to them, and get it out to them so that they can have the comfort to know that, you know, they calculated the snapshot correctly and whatever, but we want to be there for them. So again, if it is your first case, give us a call, send us an email, let us know that we're ready to help you with that.
That is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we'll follow up with you later this week. Thank you again, Dale, for your great presentation, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. And please don't forget to complete that post-webinar survey to receive a certificate of attendance for CLE. Have a great afternoon, everyone.